Well, welcome everybody. This is our third session in the listening room. The last one will be tomorrow night at 8, because what everybody wants to do on a Friday night at 8 o'clock is listen to a 20 to 5 minute radio documentary. But it's a really good radio documentary. One of my favorites. So the theme for today's session is tension or conflict. Now, I know you all remember this from 6th through 7th grade, right? There are different kinds of conflict. Usually we talk about person versus person, but what are the other kinds of conflict that we think about in stories?
Person versus nature.
Okay, person versus nature.
Person versus self.
Person versus self. That's one of my favorites.
Versus society.
Society or institution. I think it's usually society / institution, maybe. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Zombies.
Maybe that's nation,
right? Cultures too. Isn't there conflict between cultures?
Yeah, so yeah. Person versus society, person versus self.
Cultures.
Cultures. Person versus fate / God. That plays a ton in person versus fate is what all of the Greek dramas are about. I think it would say fate / God in the same way that we say society / institution. So the pieces that I'm going to play for you today, quite often in journalism, the conflict is played up as person versus person or institution versus institution. I think the best stories and the ones that are the most interesting to listen to are the ones that have multiple layers of conflict. So there might be person versus person. And the documentaries we've listened to earlier this week have also, dealt with some of that. But there's also a lot of person versus society in these, person versus self in at least one of them. Try to think about those various layers of conflict as you're listening to these, because I think that it'll make it a richer experience. When a reporter comes to me and says, I'd like to do a story about X, I'm always asking for various levels of conflict. Because if it's just two people arguing with each other, it's not that interesting on the radio necessarily. And you can do it, but it might just take 3 minutes and you're done.
What would be an example of some kind of interview with that and you're giving them another mandate?
Okay, so a reporter in San Diego pitched me this story this summer. She said that there's a man running for U.S. representative from San Diego, and I'd like to cover his campaign. This would be the first time he would be elected, and he has a good chance of winning. And she said, and I said, well, many hundreds of seats in Congress are up. In fact, all of them are up. So what makes this one interesting? And she said, well, he is a conservative Republican who's also openly gay. I said, oh, that's interesting. That's a little bit more. But, is that the only thing? She said, well, actually, a lot of gay groups really hate him. They're really angry with him. So I said, well, let's not make this just a story about him. Let's make this a story about, diversity within the LGBT political community. You can use him at the beginning of the story to sort of open up a larger conversation about, I think there's a lot of concern that once marriage becomes legal throughout the U.S. because the Supreme Court rules that way, that the LGBT community will fracture dramatically and won't be as aligned with the Democratic Party. So I thought this was a great opportunity to open up that larger conversation, but it also means there are lots of more levels of conflict. So that's an example of, here's a story, and I say, you can do better than that, and we go back and forth. And this is luckily a reporter who is up for a challenge like that. So I want to play, I have three pieces today. The first one, this is the first time this week that you've heard my voice, you'll hear my voice reporting stories. I think this aired in 03 or 04, it was on Weekend Edition Saturday. I won't say much more than that, but just keep in mind the various levels of conflict.
Is any sin so terrible it cannot be forgiven? Daily headlines about sexual abuse by priests in the Boston Diocese led playwright Michael Murphy to ask that question. Using documents relating to two civil sex abuse lawsuits, he found material for a new play involving the disgraced priest John Gagan, who was killed in prison last year, also Father Paul Shanley, who is awaiting trial, and Cardinal Bernard Law, the former Archbishop of Boston. The play is called Sin, a cardinal deposed, and is now playing at the Bailiwick Theater in Chicago, Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports.
Playwright Michael Murphy says what started out as research became an obsession. He spent weeks untangling 1,000 pages of Bernard Cardinal Law's legal depositions to weave a coherent narrative of what happened in the Archdiocese of Boston.
I just covered my entire apartment wall with the depositions and pictures of people that I copied off the internet or Xerox out of books and put on my wall to keep it all straight. And it all pointed back to the same thing, which is Cardinal Law, the center of this thing.
The play focuses on the Cardinal's negligence concerning the two most notorious perpetrators of child sex abuse in the Boston Archdiocese, Fathers John Gagan and Paul Shanley. In October, Murphy sent the script to the Bailiwick Theater in Chicago.
So this literally came in through the mail?
David Zack is the Bailiwick's artistic director.
I read it immediately, and we had called the playwright probably within 48 hours of the script arriving and said, this is what we want to do, and would you give us permission to do it? I think he was just as surprised as we were that it was such a fast process.
The cast rehearsed for only 3 weeks before Sin opened. Staging is simple, just two folding tables and a few chairs, legal and antiseptic. Save for Cardinal Law's priestly vestments hanging at the back of the stage, reminding the audience that the plaintiff's attorney is deposing a leader in the Catholic Church, not just another man.
Can you identify one priest who had allegations of sexual molestation brought against him, who was removed from parish ministry at this time? One priest!
I don't think there are any.
Did you ever think that there was some need for action? Even if it just involved getting the priests together and saying, this type of conduct is intolerable! Do you understand my question?
I understand the answer you want me to give.
That's the answer. No, I want to be cardinal.
Again, playwright Michael Murphy.
At some point, his desire to be the Archbishop of Boston, to be a cardinal, to be a player in the Vatican, became more important than his role as a shepherd, which is literally what a bishop is.
Victims and their relatives haunt the depositions with monologues Murphy culled from interviews he'd read in the Boston Globe.
And my child told me how everything had happened. He told me how Father Gagan threatened him. And in response, my child tried to run out our back door. But I pulled my son back and I told my son that I would never, ever stop loving him. And I told my son that no way could Father Gagan ever separate us. The thing is, it separated us.
Playwright Michael Murphy has dealt with profound tragedy before. He wrote a fictionalized account of the Columbine shootings, but he says using the real words of real people was more powerful.
There's an honesty, an lyricism that comes out of the human experience that's free of my playwriting tricks.
That honesty is exactly what Rob Scamardo, a clergy sex abuse survivor himself, found when he attended a recent Sunday matinee.
What I think the play will accomplish is to give people an opportunity to connect with the emotions of the survivors, the pain that they went through, and to see the attitude, the arrogance of the institutional church and how it dealt with claims against the priest. That's what's not coming through in terms of the media reports.
Local critics have praised the work, and sold-out audiences are often in tears as they leave the theater. Scamardo and other survivors say sitting through the closing monologue is the most difficult and unspeakably sad moment in the play. It's Patrick McSorley's story of how, at the age of 12, Father John Gagan took him for a ride to get some ice cream, then molested him.
You know, he must have sensed that I was very uncomfortable with what he was doing because he ended up slowly taking his hand out and getting me back to my house. But I just remember getting out of the car and I'm standing there with the ice cream all melted down my arm. Before he took off, I remember him saying, let's just you and me. No one else has to know about this.
Sin, a cardinal deposed, has turned out to be tragically timely. Patrick McSorley died of an apparent drug overdose just days before the play opened. In the end, McSorley didn't keep it to himself. He spent the last years of his life bringing Father Gagan and Cardinal Law to justice.
For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
So I spent, I started covering religion full-time in winter, spring of 2002, just as the whole 30 Sexist thing was like exploding. And it's probably the only thing I did for 2 years. Like I attended countless courtrooms and would like go to the congregation where the priest had just been arrested, and the weekend before or the Friday before, and I would show up there. It was some of the hardest years I've reported, but also the most meaningful in the end to me, because I just felt like, at a point when, a lot of victims were not getting very much justice, or they were constantly being told, well, we paid you off in a settlement, so you signed all these things that you wouldn't hold us responsible. And especially in the Archdiocese of Chicago, where all these secret settlements had been signed and the statute of limitations had run out in most cases, both for both criminal and civil cases. So I think there's a lot of conflicts going on in this story. What are some that you noticed right away?
It alludes to a mother-son conflict.
What's that?
The mother who ended up being separated from her son.
Yeah, there's relationship issues when that sort of stuff happens, because you look at a child who's lost his innocence in a different way than you look at the, it shatters your image of this child.
Right.
Or the kid's self-image is so damaged that he isn't able to continue normal relationships.
I'm thinking of the bishop's conflict of wanting to be the bishop and not the shepherd. That he's blinded.
I'm fascinated by the character of Cardinal Law. Very clearly committed crimes. He was being investigated on RICO statutes when he left the country and is now in the Vatican. I found in doing this piece, I actually downloaded the depositions and read the whole depositions. I think if you read them, you might not suggest. I don't think he's conflicted with himself. He knows clearly that what was most important to him was protecting the institution. I don't even think it was being bishop. I actually think that the playwright might misread that.
Okay.
He was trying to protect the institution. In reporting on this, that I tried to make really clear in my whole body of reporting was that these were company men who were trying to protect their company. And whoever got in the way of that company was steamrolled. And they were more concerned about. I would interview some of them, and they'd say, this is bringing scandal to the church.
It's all about image.
Well, and I would say, scandal to the church. You've got I interviewed Cardinal George in Chicago on the 10th anniversary of his becoming cardinal, and I asked him, take me back to that morning when you saw those headlines on the front page of the Chicago Tribune that this was all going on. What was your immediate, the first thing that went through your mind? And he said that this would scandalize the church and people would lose their faith. And I thought, and I actually said to him, you mean you weren't concerned about the kids who'd been molested? He said, no, I'm concerned about that too, but the first thing that I thought, and I just realized, you are concerned about this as an institution. And I think that this story is a lot about, the whole clergy sex abuse story is a lot about people's relationships to the institution and their conflicts with it. And, I think that Cardinal Law isn't necessarily in conflict with the institution, but he represents the institution. And everybody else's conflict seems to be with the institution. And at the end, not even so much the individual priest who committed the crime, but in that the larger church, hid it and allowed that to go on and on and on, even though they knew full well what was going on.
Seems like they have a low opinion about the movement of God and the Holy Spirit in these people. Sort of like, this is going to scandalize the church and people will leave the faith. I think people's relationship to their faith is not the institution. I think it's beyond that. Having a brother and a sister-in-law who are members of the Catholic Church, they're more offended by the inappropriate behavior of the leadership than they are. It's not their faith that's rattled, it's the behavior of the leadership
right. That
rattles them.
The institution gives God the black eye, not the other way around.
Yeah. I think that a Protestant relationship to what the church is very different than a Catholic relationship to what the church is.
Mm-hmm.
And the church being this thing that exists apart from the people is really not something that most of us would probably understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so to scandalize the church, that doesn't mean a lot to us in the same way that it would mean to somebody where the institution is actually, a larger than life, that is more than just an assembly of the people.
It's an extension of God.
Yeah.
So if you scandalize the institution, you're scandalizing God.
Yeah. I can't remember exactly how the dogmatic constitution of the church formulates it, but it is something that I think is hard for not just non-Catholics, because I think a lot of Catholics in the pews probably do believe the church is this group of people. But when you are part of the church hierarchy and you believe that the church is really the hierarchy is the church, that if the hierarchy is scandalized, then you have in some way besmirched the church.
When that most likely has been ingrained in them as part of their role.
To protect the institution.
Yeah, right. It's really part of what they're hired or called to do.
Well, and this, I was just thinking historical, that this has happened in the Catholic Church, not just with this kind of thing, but in history. That protecting the church was the important thing, not the truth of the church.
Sure.
During the Reformation and stuff, yeah.
It was interesting.
Well, did I understand the characters right in that the one who died through a drug overdose was also?
Patrick McSorley.
And so was he also the one who was given, who was giving information about the other two at the end, or am I confusing people?
So he was abused by Gagin.
Oh.
He was the kid with the ice cream cone.
Yeah.
And he didn't keep his secret.
Right, he didn't keep
his
secret.
When he died in drug overdose.
Right. Well, meaning that, he came forward and was very publicly, talked about what had happened.
Yeah.
His life was very complicated. I mean, he basically had depression throughout his life and had been on and off drugs for quite a while.
Was there one of the religious folks who turned against the other two?
No.
Okay, I'll try to think of the conflicts, but I didn't hear things correctly, so never mind.
And Cardinal Law was never accused of abuse himself.
No. What he was accused of was knowing that there were abusive priests
and not
and
doing
moving
it.
Them. And
relocating them so it wouldn't
yeah,
come to a head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Boston Globe did the primary investigative reporting on this, where they basically followed. There were a giant number of vacancies in the Archdiocese of Boston, yet there were people constantly leaving, and they were trying to figure out why that was. And so they went through tons of records and just sort of using church directories and things, figuring out where priests had moved to. There's a similar issue going on in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, where they basically moved them to Mexico, where they continue to abuse kids, but they're outside of the U.S. Justice system. And Mexico has a lot of problems, and that's not off the top of their list. So.
Wow. And did you say that Kagan was killed in prison? Was that what they said?
One of them was killed in prison. Gagin was killed in prison, and who's the other one? I can't think of his name right now. So there was one guy who, quite often, child abusers are killed in prison.
Yeah.
And part of what, our horribly problematic justice system does is put people who they know will be killed in the general population.
Mm.
And guards kind of look the other way, especially around child molesters.
Not a lot of compassion.
Yeah. I mean, you can have very hardened criminals who, would, mug you or kill you, but you abused a child, and so you're worse than it.
Mm-hmm.
So. So he was killed in prison, and there was somebody else. Fagin was killed in prison, and Shanley was awaiting trial.
Yeah.
When this piece aired. This, I mean, as I said, this piece is like 10 years old. By the way, I sound so weird here, so I had a terrible, terrible cold.
Oh,
and I was like, that's all I could do to voice this. I still remember, like, writing the piece, and I had no voice when I wrote it, and I had to voice it the next afternoon. I have two more pieces I want to play. None of which are that uplifting, actually. The last one's really sad. This one's a little better. This one's a little better. It's a little more, it's more recent, and it's not about sex abuse.
Is Friday Night Happy Bunny Kitties?
What?
Is Friday Night Happy Bunny Kitties?
No. No, it's about street preachers and a guy who interacts with them for 25 minutes. We interact with them for a year, it turns it in. I didn't bring anything happy, I'm sorry. Most of the news is sad. You know?
Because of conflicts.
Maybe next summer I'll come into like, joy. We do try to put joy in.
I'd like to focus on joy.
So this is a much less heavy piece. But think about the multiple layers of conflict in it. I think we tried to lay them out pretty clearly. And some of them are... So the ones that I was most interested in were not the ones that the reporter was most interested in. And this whole piece was kind of...
There's a conflict there.
Well, there was a conflict there because he thought that the most interesting thing was what I thought was the least interesting thing. Mm-hmm. So I kept having to push him to like... focus on this, which is why we care outside of it. It's a local story the way he was telling it, and I was trying to make it a national story. Mm-hmm. So tell me if you can hear the conflict between the two of us.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to hear his voice telling it, not me in there too, but it might be from there.
If you're standing behind poking him the whole time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Police officers in Honolulu can't have tattoos showing when they're on the job. That ban went into effect there today. That's similar to policies in other cities, including New York and Los Angeles. But for Native Hawaiians, tattoos are often a part of their cultural heritage. They say covering the body art impinges on their religious freedom. Wayne Yoshioka of Hawaii Public Radio filed this report.
A Native Hawaiian cultural tattoo is tapped into the skin using a handheld tool. It resembles a miniature rake with needle-sharp tines made of animal tusks dipped in black ink.
Kakao is what we do, but what is remaining is called kuhi.
Keone Nunes is a practitioner who taps out tattoo designs just as they were done 1,000 years ago. Kuhi, or the artwork, Nunes says, is secondary to the prayers, protocols, and techniques used in the ancient Native Hawaiian process.
The symbols identified who you were, identified who your family had protective meanings for it. And so there is a huge religious connotation to it.
But Honolulu's police chief sees it differently. Louis Kealoha is a Native Hawaiian who has a cultural tattoo on his right bicep, but says his dress and grooming policy establishes uniform standards without exceptions.
You cannot say everybody with a cultural tattoo, you know, that's okay because you're expressing your cultural side. You can do that off duty, but you cannot have any visible tattoos that's going to take away from the professional image of the officer and of the reputation of the police department.
More than 400 Honolulu police officers, 20% of the force, have tattoos on their arms, necks, or faces. Their options are to remove the tattoos, cover them with skin-colored makeup, or wear long-sleeved shirts.
Well, I have several tattoos on my right arm. Almost all of them are visible in a short-sleeved uniform.
Patrol officer Nick Schlepak has tattoos from his wrist to his elbow. Schlepak says covering up tattoos is about more than culture. It can also be risky.
A long-sleeved uniform can be used against an officer. A suspect can grab a hold of it. Sometimes it's hard to get their hands off of it. So you can have safety issues in that respect.
Schlepak also says there are comfort and cost considerations. Long-sleeved, dark blue uniforms are hot in tropical weather and cost up to $40 more than a short-sleeved version. Honolulu Police Union Chair Stan Aquino says the department should not penalize officers with tattoos.
Our main purpose here is to identify where the cost is going to be coming from. You know, we believe it should come from the employer and not from the individual officers themselves.
The department already pays more than $300 annually for uniforms and basic upkeep. But the main issue isn't really about money, comfort, or safety. Tattoo practitioner Nunes says it's the cultural meaning and expression that's important.
When they say that you have to cover up your tattoos or we're not going to hire you because of the tattoos, they're looking at it from a very Western perspective. But when you look at it in a more indigenous perspective, they're not understanding the conflicts that might occur with the Freedom of Religion Act and things of that nature.
The Honolulu Police Department motto is integrity, respect, and fairness. Officers with tattoos say they would like the department to respect their freedom to express their culture. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Yoshioka in Honolulu.
So can you tell what I was most interested in versus what the reporter was most interested in?
Yeah. I liked how they introduced it as like a part of the whole like rest of the country, but then he like focused specifically on more the cultural aspect. And I could see where you would want to bring it into the like the national conversation, because or like connect that, because otherwise it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I was very interested in the cultural aspects of, yeah, of the conflict. The reporter seemed obsessed with the fact that these shirts were $40. Yeah. And I was like, I don't care. I don't know any listener who's going to care. Like, think of who the listeners are. I mean, are they really going to say, like, a long-sleeve shirt, big woo?
You know?
Or, I mean, I guess you can make sort of safety concerns, but I mean, I kept pushing him on this, like, $40 is not that much for a shirt. And he said, well, yeah, I guess because the department actually pays for the shirts anyway. And I was then it's not even an issue.
Not even really.
I mean, if you get $300 a year for shirts.
You have to buy jackets for a place in Minnesota.
Well, right, this is Honolulu, though,
so it's
something.
I can understand why you would want it just because of the tropical aspect.
Yeah. But I felt like the important conflict in the story was the cultural.
Yeah, yeah. The cultural pieces.
But I also, what I find interesting about this, and like, most of the stories that I edit, I don't necessarily have a really strong opinion about whose idea is right. And I thought it was really interesting that the police chief, who's also Native Hawaiian, has Native Hawaiian tattoos. And so I was kind of interested in the, like, person versus self idea there. And, you know, I kind of wanted the reporter to get into that a little bit more. I don't think he really got that from him very much. But you can
really
imagine there's a conflict there.
Yeah, in our culture, it just explodes into the whole thing about, well, what about my culture? Well, what about my opinion of our personal art and that? And because it's become such a pervasive part of our culture.
Right. I mean, but that what a uniform is the idea of a uniform is that you don't customize your own uniform. But I think it's different when it's, so it's one thing if like, it was people like bedazzling a uniform, but this was like part of your body. And so, and I know that like the US military has similar rules, like you can't be, I don't think you can go above a certain level, you can't be promoted above a certain level if you have like a full sleeve tattoo.
And then there was the hair issue, like the
right
with black women's hair had to be like only three different styles. And
right,
like,
there were
these
braids.
Styles are ridiculous.
Right, there were braid styles that were allowed, but there were like dread styles that weren't allowed.
Yeah.
That's
Do you
just,
know
that's
if the
just,
reporter had a tattoo?
I don't know. I didn't ask him.
But it's not. Yeah, I mean, it's how you frame the problem.
Yeah. I mean, at some level, this is just like a very banal kind of conflict that isn't that interesting nationally. But then when you start thinking, oh, well, you know, people in... And even like, you know, non-cultural tattoos, I think might also be, you know, open for debate, like in Los Angeles or New York, where like you might have, you
something
know,
somebody...
some a heart on your forearm or something like that, that, you know, that was your decision to do, but it's also like, you know, it's not a cultural thing necessarily, or maybe it is, and maybe I'm misunderstanding tattoo culture. But if like Polynesian culture involves these, and we try to do that at the beginning, where the tattoo artist is explaining, like these aren't just decorations; these have meaning.
I mean, if you extrapolate that kind of those questions to a larger level, you run into. I remember a couple years ago. I don't know where it stands now, but in France, on your state ID, Muslim women who normally wanted to wear a cover could not.
Right.
And so you extrapolate, and that's another, I think.
I think that's still true in France.
It could be, yeah, but it's, you know, it's that related question of what are these common, you know, where does the state have a right to say these things, and where does it not?
Right, I mean, I think that in the United States, because of the First Amendment, there's much more individual liberty given to a person to express their religious identity. Whereas in France, being part of French culture is more important than being an individual.
Sure.
So I remember thinking that was a really interesting story, because I could see both sides. I feel like if that had happened in the United States, it would be a very different story than happening in a place where there isn't a tradition or a law about religious liberty.
It also has to do with really being able to see the face, though, too, on your ID.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they were talking about hijabs too. They weren't just talking about veils.
Oh, okay. Well, and I would be interested to know about the state law, employment laws. I noticed, looking at the website of this Stehekin Valley Ranch, that they didn't want to hire people with tattoos. Mm-hmm. They just brought up all this topic about whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
what are the laws?
Private employers can set all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. You know, but I don't know about state employers. They could probably create rules. I mean, the police department here was creating a rule.
Yeah.
What's interesting, I think that, you know, places like New York and LA created those, and many cities have these laws, but I just wanted to mention two of the biggest. Because tattoos are, in many instances, related to gang membership, and so they didn't want people confusing the officers with the, I don't know that would happen. But.
If you kind of went with some of that concept of community policing that places try and do, I mean, someone could create the argument that it would be easier for folks to identify with police people if they had tattoos and that was who they were.
Yeah.
But that does,
I mean, I think that Hawaii is a great example of a place where that could really work to their advantage to have.
Yep.
Well, actually, a lot of cities too, frankly, in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I have one more piece for you, and it's a little bit long. It's about 7 minutes. This piece is the reason I couldn't come here for Snowdance this year, because I was in Uganda. I'm
jealous.
It's not that fun a place.
No.
It was interesting, but I won't be going back, partially because of this piece. I'll just play it for you, but think about the multiple layers of conflict in this story, and then I'll talk a little bit about my own experience reporting this piece.
You might have noticed that we have reporters from all over the world on our show. Last fall, Ugandan journalist Rebecca Virungi worked with us, and while she was here, NPR's Jason DuRose stopped by for a visit. She told him about an exchange program for U.S. journalists to go to Uganda, so he applied. He wanted to report on Uganda's anti-homosexuality bill, which has been signed into law. It makes being gay punishable by life in prison, and also makes giving aid to gays and lesbians a crime, with long prison sentences. DuRose got the fellowship and traveled to Uganda to talk with folks who would be most affected by the law and those trying to help them.
Amazing grace, how sweet the song.
You'd think it would be difficult to find Uganda's LGBT community, given the severe punishments they face. But after a few emails and a couple of phone calls, you'd find St. Paul's Reconciliation and Justice Center, just off one of Kampala's main roads. St. Paul's is a Christian ministry that does outreach to gays and lesbians who have nowhere else to turn. People who have been thrown out of their homes and kicked out of their jobs.
I was hungry and you fed me. Fasted and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger and you received me.
On Sunday afternoons, a dozen or so people gather in a makeshift chapel set up in a small garage. They sing hymns, pray, and hear scripture readings. What's going on here is essentially illegal, supporting and consoling LGBT folks. Among those sitting on St. Paul's white plastic lawn chairs on the day I visited were Nathan and Ronald.
It's like, the reason why I'm here, I say, okay, we feel comfort.
This is Nathan, he's 19.
Like, we feel comfort when we are together, we as gay, like, we feel good.
Parishioners here are so afraid, they ask to only use their first names. Sitting next to Nathan is his boyfriend, Ronald.
Well, I'm here to pray and to meet my friends in the community. Yeah.
Ronald, who's 23, says he comes here to pray and be with friends and community. He was raised in the church, as were most people in this very religious country. But the Church of Uganda, which is Anglican, is not welcoming of gays and lesbians, and is, in fact, a strong supporter of Uganda's anti-homosexuality law. Ronald says there is simply nowhere else for him to turn apart from St. Paul's.
The only place is here.
Ronald is essentially homeless, living with friends when he can. His boyfriend, Nathan, is a little luckier. At least his mom didn't kick him out.
My mom knows what I am, that I'm gay. So from the first she knew, see, like, she knows that I'm gay. She started supporting me. But my dad was deaf. She used to say that, like, he had a devil into me.
A devil. You hear that a lot when you talk to LGBT folks here. They've been told they're evil. That's why the message of St. Paul's Reconciliation and Justice Center is so unusual.
And this is really giving hope to people.
That's Bishop Christopher Senyonjo, founder of St. Paul's.
Because the people have been being told God does not love you unless you change. But this is very discouraging. And until that person, no, God created you and loves you.
That love he's talking about, you can see it radiating from his face. But Bishop Senyonjo has been preaching that message his entire life. He's not gay, nor are his children. His stance has cost him his pension and his position in the Church of Uganda. The bishop's been defrocked. So why does being a pastor to gays and lesbians matter so much to him?
Because we are human beings. If one part of the humanity suffers, I think one shouldn't say, oh, that does not concern me. And that's why I feel some people are discouraged and say, this is not our business. But if we are humans, we should find out what are the values as human beings.
What Senyonjo is talking about is not just gay rights. They're human rights. And that connection is at the heart of attorney Adrian Juko's work.
This issue is not necessarily about homosexuality. You know, it's beyond homosexuality. It's about the civic space in Uganda.
By civic space, Juko means civil society, a democracy that works with freedom of press and freedom of speech, but more importantly, freedom to live your life the way you choose. And if you frame it that way, he says you can begin to talk about gay people as human beings. Until recently in Uganda, you couldn't even say the word homosexual out loud.
And we now have that word being spoken because now every day on radio, someone is talking about homosexuality. Until you switch on homosexuality in the papers, homosexuality. So now it's a word that everyone can talk about.
So, says Juko, gay rights can be a catalyst for opening a larger, necessary conversation in Uganda.
Whereby really every human being deserves an opportunity. However different you are, however diverse you are.
Back at St. Paul's Reconciliation and Justice Center, the conversation is less about rights of opportunity and more about a fundamental right. The right not to be afraid in your own city, or your own church, or your own home. That's a right few people here have. I ended my conversation with 19-year-old Nathan by asking him if there was something he wanted the people who hear this story to know. Here's what he told me.
In Uganda, we are not in good life totally. We are gay. Yeah. So I would like to tell them that if they get anything they can help us. They help us.
Help us. But what help might look like is unclear. Chances aren't good for Nathan or his boyfriend Ronald. They have little education and no money. To claim asylum, they'd first have to get to the US or Europe. But even if they could find their way out, there's no guarantee life would be better, paved with opportunities. We talked just a few weeks before Uganda's president signed the anti-homosexuality bill. Once it became law, Ronald and Nathan felt so unsafe in Kampala, they fled to a village a few hours outside the capital, where they continue to hide and wait.
The Lord has promised good to me.
For Cross Currents, I'm Jason DeRose.
I shall as long or he shall be, as long as life endures.
There's a lot going on in that piece. So what are the different levels of conflict that you've heard? I think maybe all of them are in there.
I think the fate that somebody is born gay and that puts them into conflict before they even probably even know who they are.
You know, the interesting thing to me when I I proposed doing this story before I even got there. So by the time I got there, I'd already started making a few connections. And every single person that I talked to, because there were some other journalists with me, was like, why do you care so much about this in Uganda? Why does the West care so much about this issue in Uganda? And the sort of the joke became like, Uganda has 99 problems, but the gays aren't one. I kept saying, I think that it's because, why the U.S., we don't pay any attention to Uganda, but this got a lot of press. Here. I said, well, I think that the United States is moving in one direction very quickly, and your country's moving in the other direction on this issue, and that's just fascinating to us. Then I also, you know, I don't know if any of you have seen the documentary God Loves Uganda.
No.
Actually, it'd be worth something doing for in a document, one of your documentaries, watching things. There's a lot of U.S. influence. Some U.S. evangelicals spent a ton of time and money getting that law passed.
It's sick.
Because they felt like they were losing here, and they wanted to win somewhere. And so they...
How about metal?
In fact, on the plane ride over, there were tons of missionaries. I kept saying, you know, this country's 95% Christian. Why are you going over there to be a missionary?
Mm-hmm.
And the country's mostly Anglican and Catholic. Well, right. But.
Do they try and reach out to those people?
What do you mean?
The folks that are so intent on it being sin or whatever it is. I don't know what they...
Illegal.
I don't know what they think it is.
Yeah.
But what's the point if they're not... I mean, if they do think it's something that is going to come between the individual and God, and they care about that, then do something about that. Why does so much money go into just bullshit?
That's a good question. I mean, especially in a country that's as poor as Uganda.
I don't get what somebody different than me is going to do to hurt me. Why such a huge defense?
I think that you have to also understand, though, that in Uganda, this is, you know, the individual is key in the United States and in much of the West, but this is an interesting conversation I kept having with people. They would say, well, this separates people from the community, and that's why it's bad. Because, if there's a gay kid in the community, then it separates them from the community and destroys the community. And I said, no, that doesn't happen in the United States as often as it used to. There are gay pastors and gay doctors and lawyers and gay journalists, and, it's not... I mean, in some places it's still problematic, but in many places it's not anymore. So it doesn't have to separate somebody from the community. And they were like, I don't understand what you're talking about. How could it not?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I went over, just really fascinated by what is really going on with this. And I just realized that, we have such completely different worldviews about the role of the individual in society and the role of the individual in community. And how here, you could change the community and change the society. And it just seems like it's working really, really fast here right now. But it just seems so... impossible there. Although, I think that 50 years ago it seemed impossible here, so.
Mm-hmm. Because I remember at our church watching Pastor Rockwalner go through this Whoa. Struggle. Holy crap. getting to reconciled in Christ was, I sat through several of the meetings and just bawled my heart out. And I didn't know where I stood necessarily at the beginning, but by the end it was clear to me that being reconciled in Christ is there's just no other answer. If God is love, there's no other answer. And I
that
watched Pastor
25 years. Well,
right,
20 years ago.
But I remember there was a gay pastor who was married and had kids, and his wife left him, and he was telling his story. He had repressed all of his thoughts and feelings, so and did everything he could to be straight. And to the point of getting married and having children. Remember that session? Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh. And he said his wife woke up one day and said, you know what, we need to get divorced. And he was like, what? And she said, you know, oh, Don, you're gay and you don't even know it. and he here's this man sitting in front of this community, half of which the people were hostile toward gay people in general. Other half were like, And he's telling the story, and
but it didn't move that hostile group.
It did not move them. No, they left, which was that's their prerogative. But it the remnant that remained, I think, is stronger and more compassionate, and it's a better place. And I watched the pastor go. The pastor started out, I think, probably oversimplification, but love the sinner, hate the sin, and over the course of a couple of years. It was able to embrace it, and I watched his theology change, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where I saw a dynamic God at mm-hmm. work.
I mean, I'm coming from kind of a different view, but just the cultural thing, there's also the issue of, like, HIV, and that's connected to homosexuality in their culture.
Actually, most HIV in Africa is heterosexually.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's still like very much connected to the whole.
They imagine it to be but
issue.
It's,
yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, it's still that's part of the issue, and I think that's part of why that it's.
The president of Uganda maintains there's no HIV in Uganda.
Well, yeah, which is totally.
The president maintains there's no HIV.
Well, he says so. I'm sure it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I've
been to Kampala, and it was kind of, we were doing medical stuff, and that was seemed very much connected, and that, to me, that's probably a big reason why
they feel.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that they can support.
Yeah, I think it's probably one of many reasons.
Yes.
What I wondered when I was listening to it is how the Anglican Church is arranged, and if there's some kind of international Anglican Church, and how that body views,
and I can't think of how that works. I mean, it's the church is split very much so, with the power now still in the north, based in England, of course, but the growing numbers in the south, and so looking at maybe a shift of that power in sometime in the future, and it's the growing in evangelism in the southern hemisphere, so it's very much an issue.
I mean, each church within the Anglican Communion can basically do what it wants to do. Just as the U.S. expression of Anglicanism, the Episcopal Church, has a gay bishop and has several gay bishops actually, and has had gay priests for decades now. It has female bishops as well. Remember in like the. Right after Gene Robinson was elected in, 03, when he was elected Episcopal Bishop in New Hampshire, several Episcopal dioceses across the U.S. left the Episcopal Church here. It was the Anglican Church in Uganda that they joined, and that Archbishop there created a non-geographic diocese in the United States to care for those clergy who left. And so I think three dioceses left, and then a bunch of individual congregations left and joined the Anglican Church in Uganda. So there's a long history of Uganda-U.S.
Over that issue specifically.
Yeah.
Well, the Book of Mormon is set in Uganda, too.
Yeah, it is.
Which is pretty interesting.
Yes. Nobody there knows that, though, I have to say. I was there with two other U.S. journalists,
yeah.
and we were sort of singing Hasadega Ibo.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't know it.
That's good.
Yes?
Jason, in your time there, did you get a sense, you said earlier, quite correctly, that on a political level, the United States really does not pay any attention to countries like Uganda.
Right, right.
Do you get a sense that for people in the political control of the government in Uganda, this is an opportunity to get some attention and maybe get something out of it on a political level that otherwise they couldn't have? Because in some sense, I can see how people in the Anglican Church leadership may well believe this, whatever. And there may be some politicians, but I have a sense that my question is, do you get a sense that there's something else going on?
Yeah, there's a lot more going on than this. So, the reason it was passed, this is a country where, almost everybody, in polite conversation, people will say, oh yes, the gay should be killed. So this is a and it's a real rallying point politically. So if, the president or the speaker of the house is being investigated for massive corruption, you can whip up a bill like this and get everybody on their side and say, oh, this is great. We can pass, we can pass this. And isn't the government doing something great now, even though they've embezzled hundreds of millions of dollars from an extraordinarily poor country? So I think there's a lot more going on. Now, so this bill was passed right before Christmas of last year. And it was technically passed without a quorum in Parliament. And so when I was there was this, the president was saying, I don't think I can sign this because it was passed without a quorum. But then, some other little investigation sort of bubbled up around corruption, and he signed it anyway. And then just a couple of weeks ago, their version of the Supreme Court, the High Constitutional Court, said, well, it wasn't passed with a quorum in the Parliament, so we're overturning the law. They didn't overturn the law on the merits of the case, they overturned it on it not being passed properly. It'll pass properly eventually, and they'll probably just, rev it up again when some other corruption scandal happens. There's also a lot going on with who's going to succeed Museveni. Museveni, it's very unclear how old he is, because he was born in a tribal area and doesn't have a birth certificate, but you can't be president over a certain age in Uganda. And he's changed that age once because he claimed to be a certain age, and then that was also a fake age, but then he changed it again. I mean, as I said, there are 99 problems, and the gays aren't one. So there's a lot more going on, and this just happens to be, the thing that they can hawk up.
It's a distraction they use
yeah.
politically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's a game politicians. Play.
Yeah.
We play everyone.
Yeah. I just recently found out, I'm not really covering this story anymore, but I just recently found out that because of all the bad press that this, I think that Uganda was genuinely surprised that the U.S. was upset by this passing of this bill. Because I think really there are people who did not understand how we would react to it. I mean, even very conservative people here would not say kill the gays or imprison them for life. Museveni's government is now paying $500,000 a month to a PR firm in Washington, D.C. to change our image, to change the U.S. understanding of Uganda. But, Pope Francis is also paying $500,000 a month to that same PR firm so that you all think that Pope Francis is a great guy. $500,000 a month.
Wow.
I need to, if I ever bag business. This journalism thing, I'm going into PR.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, no, I have to lose my soul first.
Buy it back later.
Yeah, I guess. We're actually over time now, and I don't know if people want to go to the tour of the mind. So thank you all for coming to this. I hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow night, we're meeting at 8. p.m. instead of 5, because 5 o'clock is going to be a climate change session. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.